So 1 Corinthians, written by Paul to the church in Corinth. And in 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 8, Paul describes a more excellent way, a more excellent way contrasted with the spiritual gifts that the Christians at Corinth were arguing about which is more important. And he says, I tell you now a more excellent way. Let's just read 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 8 to get our minds and hearts prepared for what our discussion will be about this morning. 1 Corinthians 13, 4. Love is patient. Love is kind and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own, is not provoked. Love does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away. This morning, let's focus on one of these attributes of love, which is, does not seek its own. Let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul greets the church in Corinth. He offers them endearing comments. And then he gets to the point of his letter. In verse 10, 1 Corinthians 1:10, now I exhort you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment. Several words in that verse are about the unity of this church, the church in Corinth. And what follows in the book of the letter of 1 Corinthians is several issues that were complicating the unity of the church in Corinth. Can you recall one of the issues that was facing the church in Corinth?
Immorality.
Immorality. Right. Right. There was divisions amongst the Christians about who they were following, who they put their respect towards or allegiance towards, and that created divisions among their church. And they were even boasting about this. What is another instance in which the Corinthian church was struggling with division? We have I'm Apollos. Also, they were struggling with taking each other to court. They would raise legal issues amongst each other and take each other to court. And that was an issue Paul addresses in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Right. And that's going to be a major one we're going to talk about, is that they were being ignorant or arrogant of the state of faith of the members of their church. Some had different understandings on what to do about food sacrificed to idols. And so Paul goes into depth about that in a couple chapters, chapter 8, chapter 10. Any other issues that was facing the church in Corinth? We've already named three. Right. That issue Paul addresses pretty, strictly how they're supposed to address that issue. How about when they were taking the Lord's Supper? Y'all remember the issue that was facing them when they were taking the Lord's Supper, that church in Corinth? Some were full, some were drunk, others were starving. They weren't being considerate of each other. And that was creating tension, complicating their unity, that issue they were facing. And then, as we talked about briefly at the beginning of the class, they're vying for respect about their spiritual gifts, thinking some spiritual gifts were more important than others. So all these issues that we've... There may even be another issue about whether or not they were going to support Paul. Paul was willing to work at that time, and he worked with his own hands and taught. Later on, we'll find out that they were very liberal in their giving, but at this point in time, Paul had to work. So, and Paul did that because he didn't want to create a issue for them to deal with when it comes to spreading the gospel. But these other issues, what they all have in common is that they were rooted in self-seeking behavior, in a self-seeking attitude. So, what are some examples of self-seeking behavior that we ourselves may struggle with? Our own self-interest. Can you think of an example in your life or that you've witnessed in which you were seeking self at the cost of unity? Wealth, exactly. And what goes into wanting wealth? Your time, your effort, your motivation, your purpose. If your purpose is pursuit of wealth, you are then holding your efforts, your resources, from being spent towards your brother. Anything else about self-seeking behavior? Great example. Right. We can be confident that there are brethren amongst us, even here now, each of us could benefit from time, love, effort shown towards us by our brethren. But if we use our time to do things other than serve our brethren, such as times just enjoying our own pleasures, our own comforts, that's a resource. Our time is a resource that God's blessed us with. And if we hoard that time, we've squandered a resource that we could use to serve our brother and maintain unity. Any other examples of self-seeking behavior, self-interest? Right. That you said a few small words in there that are buzzwords for self-interest. I and me and mine. These words, if they are our first reaction towards an issue, you already can detect that there's a self-interest, self-seeking attitude in that. And why is that our first inclination to result or to respond with I think, my perspective, my reasons are this? Why not instead our instinct be the brethren, unity, my neighbor, my spouse? These are the counter response to self-seeking behavior. And Steve also mentioned opinions, and we're going to talk about opinions in a little bit. But our opinions is something that are derived from our own self, thinking, self-generated. And what do we do with our opinions, and are they used to maintain unity? Rocky?
Generally, just say as fathers and as husbands, we may sometimes put our interests before the wives and family. It may be time, it might be hobbies, money situations. So seeking our own interests before the wife and the husband.
Right. Any issues? That's exactly what a couple of these, or almost all of these issues that was facing them, was wanting superiority or wanting something that another brother had or didn't want that brother to have. And that's going to create division. This jealousy is it's based off self-interest. Right.
I know they'll just repeat it. Why should I have so much compassion?
Right. Self-righteousness, where I would never do that. I don't want to be associated with that. That's beneath me. I'm above that, superior. You know, these are the issues that we're also facing the First Corinthians, or the church in Corinth, too. So these are, I wanted to just go through that short, you know, exercise to get ourselves mindful of self-interest behavior, self-interest, self-seeking behavior. So just one more, kind of more probing into self-interest. What leads us to do that? What is the, you know, the crux, the motivation for us to seek self, to serve self? And not why don't we just instinctively serve others automatically? Right. Pride. Thank you. Definitely pride. Anything else? Any other sins we may, lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, pride of life? Greed. Right.
I eat, don't you?
Sure.
So I'm concerned about self. And if I love a neighbor as myself, I better learn to love myself in that sense. But that's a limited sense.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's what it our seeking our self-interest does result in something that we may want, good or bad. We may want to have enough money to just, you know, take care of our family and contribute to, you know, good works. But once we go beyond that, it's now, yes, our bank account may grow, and we may have more things, more pleasures, more comforts. And that is self-fulfilling. But that is a world self-fulfillment. And so it's kind of the you know, dichotomy, the man that we are, but the spiritual being, the flesh versus the spirit. So the flesh wants us to fulfill its needs and go even beyond. But our spirit knows that the spiritual things are far more important. So with all this in mind, let's dive into 1 Corinthians. So we talked about a few of the issues that was facing the church in Corinth. Let's start with 1 Corinthians chapter 4. Six through eight. Now these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, so that in us you may learn not to exceed what is written, so that no one of you will become arrogant in behalf of one against the other. So this is in response to them thinking, I'm of Paul, I am of Cephas, I'm Apollos, and there being divisions amongst who they place the highest esteem. So he says, in verse 6, so that no one will become arrogant in behalf of one against the other. Verse 7, for who regards you as superior? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it? You are already filled. You have already become rich. You have become kings without us. And indeed, I wish that you had become kings, so that we also might reign with you. So what does Paul expose here in their interest in being respected by having an origin from Cephas or Paul or Apollos? What does he expose here in verse, is it verse 7? Right. That's what he addresses in verse 8, where you have already become rich. You have become kings because of your faith. What more do you need? He exposes in verse 6 that this attitude is arrogant. And it's arrogant towards each other. It's arrogance in behalf of themselves and not in the interest of the other. So then he asks this question. Who regards you as superior? Who regards them as superior? Is this a rhetorical question? And you know, rhetorical questions, you can try to answer them. There may be multiple answers. There might not be an answer, but it's meant to make you think. So, for who regards you as superior? Good point. Their self. Their self-interest. They want to think and feel that they are superior. Superior compared to who? They want to be superior to their brother? Where is the love? Where is the selflessness in that? So he's pointing out with this rhetorical question, what is the root of your attempt to be superior, to align yourself with the more perceived to be superior teacher? So are they really regarded as superior if they are from Paul or Cephas or Apollos? Are they superior? What does it even mean to be superior? How would a brother be superior of a brother? Right. That they're more important, they're more valuable to the church, that they're, more appreciated by God. Is that the idea? What are they thinking? So he exposes that. He exposes that quickly with the next rhetorical question. What do you have that you did not receive? And what had they received? They had received the teaching from all these men, from Paul and Apollos and Cephas and Christ, and then the prophets even among them, the teachers among them. They had all just been mere recipients of it. And does being a recipient make you superior to your brother? Right. Right. And for what purpose did they have these gifts? For the benefit of their brother.
All throughout Corinthians, he's pointing out that they consider themselves superior. They're down in the fall. You know, the bit about he comes with this meanness of speech, he's riding to bowl, you know. He's an apostle of Christ.
Right.
People who are appalled at this period deceive us. And that is very evident.
And what he points out is, you know, forget about this. Who are you of? What's the origin of your teaching? From what person? He points out in verse 8, you are already filled. You have already become rich. You have become kings without us. And indeed, I wish that you had become kings so that we might also reign with you. So I ask this question. Does Paul want them to believe they are super or superior? Super or superior? No. Does he want them to realize how awesome it is what they have, though? That they're that they've received the message, the salvation of Christ. And he uses the word kings. You have become kings, even without us, without Paul or Apollos, who, you know, he's referencing up in the beginning of this chapter. That they have become kings. And Paul goes even farther, saying, we wish that you had become kings. Why? So that we can reign with you. So that we can share in this grace, this salvation, this great message with you. So Paul expressed, does Paul want to reign over them or with them? With them. He wants to share. He wants to be one with them. Yes, Don. Right.
I mean, you're king. Oh, I wish you were king so that we could become kings with you, reign with you. He's not, and from the way I'm reading it, I don't know that he's wanting them to think they're already kings, but he's being very sarcastic, trying to.
That's a good point.
Get them to,
yeah.
Like, wake up.
Right, right. They certainly, now, the Christians, this could have been based on seeing the value of the message that they were receiving from these people. They said, I'm of Paul. I'm proud of what I heard from Paul, or Apollos, or Cephas. They were proud to have heard what they had heard from him, and they wanted to identify with him. Was that necessarily rooted in some evil, harboring within their soul? Or did they see that this is so important, I want to identify with that? But by doing that, do they then forget that their brother is important with them? That their brother, though maybe from a different teacher, should also be recognized as important. Not superior or inferior, but great. Great that they've received this message too. That's where the self-interest that they, you know, Paul's going to say in 1 Corinthians 13, does not seek its own. And they were seeking their own in the sense of superiority amongst their brethren. A grinding aggressive.
This is Corinth. These people are Greeks. And the Greeks had a very strong tendency. Well, there were a lot of teachers in a lot of schools in Greece. And some of them we remember to this day.
Right.
But they all had this tendency to think that their teacher was superior to any other teacher. And because they followed that teacher, they were superior to any other students of any other group.
Right.
They're just being Greeks.
Right.
So they're, you know, well, of course, when you were a Jew, you did the same thing. But Paul, I would, Gamaliel, you know. Well, you know, even Paul says this, I've sat at the feet of Gamaliel, that makes me better than you. Of course, he's being ironic when he said it.
Right. Right, right. You know, I think about how we could even be today. And, you know, each congregation may have a different preacher who may focus on a different method of delivering God's message. And we may perceive that preacher as being different than our preacher. And we may align with our preacher and identify as we are Christians that are Christians connected to our preacher, and even view Christians from other congregations differently because of we're aware of what their preacher's like, and you know the types of messages that are brought there and how the message is brought. But do we do? Could that happen because we are wanting to feel superior in relation to other brethren? Or instead, can we view our brothers as, you know, just ignore that part and just recognize that they are recipients of God's message of Christ's salvation, and you embrace them as just as important, as just as cherished by God as you are? I want to expose any area in our hearts that might lean towards our self-interest. And if these things may be present in us, let's recognize it and make the change as Paul was asking this church to do. He addressed them as brethren, but he addresses that they have issues they have to face. And that's also why I said in our prayer, can we be honest with ourselves and look in our hearts and find somewhere in our hearts where we may have our own self-interest, where that's rooted, and not let that be there, rather be in the interest of our brother, in the preservation of unity. So let's read 1 Corinthians 1:26-29. So here Paul will probe the counter-worldly nature of a Christian's calling. Verse 26, 1 Corinthians 1:26. For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong, and the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God. What are these? So we've been talking kind of like spiritual, who was your teacher, and aligning with them. But here we're looking at the counterworldly nature of a Christian's perspective on importance versus a worldly perspective. So what are the two things that are being compared and contrasted here in this 26 through
29? The worldly view and the spiritual view of the gospel of Christ, of God, and how he calls men to salvation. The world thinks it's foolish. The world thinks it's unwise, you know. But spiritual
right. These elevated positions of being mighty, of being noble, these are according to the flesh. These are what the world places high esteem on. This is what the world thinks is interesting and worth working towards and giving your time, your effort, your energy, your purpose, your motivation towards achieving what is mighty, what is noble. But God chose the opposite of these things to be what is important. Humility, selflessness, self-giving, servanthood, considering others first. These are the things that God has placed as important. But the world wants to convince us that you should preserve yourself. You should seek to elevate yourself. And in doing so, who gets in your way? People can get in your way. And if someone gets in your way, get them out of your way. Is that best for them? Oftentimes, no. But a Christian's perspective is, Our goal is the salvation of our souls and the salvation of all other souls, our brethren and our neighbor. And so that's what we will strive towards, even if it means not being in a noble position, not being mighty, not having the world's, you know, titles, positions. So, examples in our world today. How can a misunderstanding of the counterworldly nature of the Christian's calling manifest in our attitudes and actions? What could we do that would be not in alignment with this counterworldly nature? Right. That's what we should do. What might we do, though, that is the opposite of that?
Start pursuing your own personal goals.
Right.
Start to say, oh, I want to get that bigger house now. Oh, I want to climb up the corporate ladder now.
And it starts with a thought. What do I want? Do I want that power? Do I want that money? Do I want that respect? Do I want those things? Do I want the house? That's seated in the self-interest motive that is being exposed throughout this letter. And how it can also affect how we treat our brother. If we don't see them as part of elevating ourselves, then we might not treat our brother like we should. If what matters to us is the flesh and what is according to the flesh. So we have that dichotomy, the flesh and the spirit. And the self-interest serves the flesh. The selfless man, woman, serves the spirit, their spirit and their brother's, their neighbor's spirit. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 12, 22 through 26. And this is going to further explain this, this difference, this counterworldly nature that God has chosen for his kingdom. 1 Corinthians 12, 22 through 26. On the contrary, it is much truer that the members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary, and those members of the body which we deem less honorable, on these we bestow more abundant honor, and on our less presentable members become much more presentable. Whereas our more presentable members have no need of it. God has so composed the body, giving more abundant honor to that member which lacked, so that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. There we have it again. This weaker is recognized as more important, worth more of our attention, worth honor, more honor. What is this honor that he keeps referring to here? If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. What honor? Those members of the body which we deem less honorable, on those we bestow more abundant honor. What is this honor do we give them? A certificate of honor? Do we bow down to them? Or what is this honor that we're giving these members?
Spiritual gift
Right. At the beginning of the class, we talked about what issues were complicating the unity of the Corinthian church. The one of Paul, Cephas, Apollos is one, and a similar one is them attributing more honor to the spiritual gifts. And which you said two words, Steve, vital and important. And that's the recognition, the honor, the respect, the acknowledgement that they are to give every member, even the least loud or obvious or, you know, impacting, even the least, give them more abundant honor. Give attention to every brother, whatever position they're in, and recognize that they are vital to your church, to your family, to you, to God. Do we think of it like, if one member of us suffers, all of us suffer? Do we think of each of our brother like that? That if one of us is in pain or in a state of weakness, it affects all of us. That's what unity is. That's what a team that is interdependent on each of us does. And when one of us, something great happens, they overcome an obstacle. Their baptism, their repentance, their strength, their growth. Do we share in that? Do we appreciate that as if it's happening to us and our team? That's what the unity is, the sameness, the one mind that Paul's purpose of this letter is about. So, that is Paul addressing the self-seeking attitude they had with regards to, I'm of Paul, I'm of Cephas, I'm Apollos, I'm of Christ. He says, we are all kings, we all reign, we're all together, and we desire that. We are not superior. We shouldn't desire superior. Rather, each of us is vital, important, and we share in each other's pains, our growth, our weakness. Think of ourselves as one. All right, let's move to another issue that's facing them. The issue of the legal matter.
Before you move to that, John,
yes, sir.
This is along the very lines of what you're talking specifically in the Corinthian situation, seeking their own relative to unique participation in. You said if one member suffers, all the members suffer. If the guy came out of idolatry, he still struggles with idolatry. The other guy said, that's your bad luck.
Right. 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 I want to get to those two instances. I'm probably going to want to do this on Wednesday night. But you said two things there. That's your tough luck. That's your bad luck. And is that the attitude that we have towards our brother? Oh, you don't know what I know? Well, tough luck, because I'm going to go on in my liberty doing this. That's what we're going to talk about when we get to that point. Lord willing, Wednesday night. We can briefly open the topic, the discussion about this issue of them taking each other to court and how that exposes their self-interest behavior at the cost of unity. Let's read 1 Corinthians 6, 5-6. 1 Corinthians 6, 5-6. I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not among you one wise man who will be able to decide between his brethren? But brother goes to law with brother, and that before unbelievers. So what is the self-seeking behavior he's addressing here?
Taking fellowship with
taking each other to court. Verse 7 and 8. Actually, then, it is already a defeat for you that you have lawsuits with one another. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded? On the contrary, you yourselves wrong and defraud. You do this even to your brethren. Paul clarifies the spiritual significance of the problem. That is a defeat for them to take each other to court, that they wrong and defraud. What is meant by defeat? Did they already lose the lawsuit case before they even went? They didn't? What did they? Where were they defeated? Right. Their defeat is that they've sought their own interest at the cost of unity, at the cost of their brother's spiritual state. Just like you said, Alex. Their defeat is that they've lacked the spiritual strength and wisdom to resolve conflicts with brethren. Conflicts will arise, but how do we resolve them? With grace, with appreciation for brother, with selflessness or self-interest, and trying to win the legal battle.
And with forgiveness, I think that's the point he's trying to make. You know, why not rather be wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? You know, he's not making a facetious statement. He's basically saying, you know, why not have forgiveness? Why not have forgiveness rather than be wrong?
Right. That question, why not rather be wronged? Again, rhetorical, or what does it expose? Why not rather be wronged? Why not? Why not? Because it stings to be wronged from a worldly perspective. But if you're really thinking about your brother's spiritual state, his soul's eternal direction, does it really hurt that bad to be wronged? If we can have that spiritual frame of mind when conflicts arise, we'll be able to maintain unity. All right, Wednesday night, we'll keep working through the handout. Thank you.